Thank you very much, Anushka. I must say, I lost a lot of sleep last night because I was curious, you know, whether I would be introduced with reference, you know, to some philosopher, some warrior, some statesman, perhaps some comedian. I really didn't know what she was going to say, so I'm very grateful to the for the really kind introduction. I'm in a really difficult position in a variety of ways. One kind of sandwiched between Jack Matlock and Sig Hecker, great scientist, great diplomat. And while I have interesting things to tell, they probably pale in comparison to the experiences that my two colleagues have discussed. And so I decided to compensate in two ways. I'll return to this perhaps when Sig is here, because I don't think Sig even has this. These were flowers that I picked in 1997. They were blue once upon a time, near the epicenter of the first Soviet nuclear weapons test site in Semipalatinsk, about which you heard earlier today. I bring this to you because I was involved in the origins, really, of the negotiation of the Central Asian Nuclear Weapons Free Zone, representing the country of Kyrgyzstan, which in itself is an interesting story. But I plucked those flowers from the epicenter of the first Soviet nuclear test, and I was en route to the first meeting in Tashkent, which was a gathering of parties, Americans, Russians, and others, to initiate this process of the nuclear weapons free zone negotiations in Central Asia. And for me, that blue flower represented the potential future. It was a sign of hope, and so I plucked the flower, took it, and used it when I made my remarks. When I brought it back to the center here, we wanted to hang it in our seminar room. Most of my staff were scared to death, and they made me get a Geiger counter to make sure that it wasn't radioactive. I can assure you it's safe, and the flower has faded, but the concept remains intact. And in fact, we now have a nuclear weapons-free zone in Central Asia. And I can talk more about that, having been involved in those negotiations. The other two kind of props, if you will, that I brought. The first one is a book. It was called Foreign Policy, USA, USSR. That was published in 1982. And I bring that because that was when I first began to write about parallels in U.S. And Soviet nuclear export and nonproliferation policy. So that kind of dates me, but I think it's important, and I'll talk about this in my lecture, because while Sig can illustrate very, very vividly the manner in which the United States and the Russian Federation and scientists from our labs and their labs cooperated, in fact, that collaboration goes back much further. And I was able, in 1982, in fact, to point to some elements of cooperation and collaboration. So I'll talk a little bit about that. The other book I brought here is a book that I co-edited, came out in 1985, called The Nuclear Suppliers and Nonproliferation. And what I found particularly interesting when I was kind of reviewing my my notes from my presentation were the contributors to the book, and I'm just going to mention one, a name that may be familiar to you, who wrote a chapter in my book called A Soviet Perspective on the Future of Nonproliferation. Anyone want to venture a guess who contributed that chapter? I'll give you a clue. He was the co-chair of the Russian delegation to the 1995 NPT Review and Extension Conference. His name happens to be Sergei Kislyak, who's in the news. I mean, if I'd given this lecture a year ago, nobody would have a clue about whom I'm speaking. But in fact, he was trained as a nuclear scientist. I knew him when he was, this probably shouldn't say this on the record here, I knew him when he was a young diplomat at the United Nations and then at U.S. in the late 1970s, and so he contributed a chapter which also pointed to the potential for U.S. Soviet cooperation. So what I wanted to do, and Jack, since you're here, I'll repeat. I was kind of wary having you following me and having Sig preceding me, and given my absence of either diplomatic or scientific skills, what I was going to say by way of introduction to get your attention. And so what I thought I would resort to were two anecdotes, which I think are both entertaining, but I think they convey a basic message that I want to communicate to you over the course of the next hour. The first one is a story that I've heard told many times by one of my heroes, that senator, former Senator Sam Nunn, who likes to talk about Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson on a camping trip. According to the tale, after a good meal and a bottle of wine, Holmes and Watson crawled into their tent and went to sleep. Some hours later, Holmes awoke and nudged his friend, Watson, and said, "Look up and tell me what you see." Watson replied, "I see millions and millions of stars." "What does that tell you, Watson?" asked Holmes. Watson pondered a minute and replied, "Astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is a quarter past three. What does it tell you, Holmes?" Holmes was silent for a moment, then spoke, "Watson, you idiot, someone's stolen our tent." I could connect that to the lecture topic in just a moment. The second story involves a baby polar bear on an ice cap with his parents. The baby bear goes up to his mother and asks, "Am I a true-blooded polar bear?" "Why, certainly," his mother tells him. "Absolutely pure polar bear?" "Yes, not grizzly bear." By now his mother is beginning to lose patience with the cub and says, "You're a 24-carat polar bear, but if you don't believe me, go ask your father." So the baby bear trots across the ice to his father, who's sitting by an ice hole eating a seal. "Daddy," says the cub, "am I a pure polar bear?" "No doubt about it," Father Polar Bear replied through a mouthful of blubber. "You're a dyed-in-the-wool polar bear from tail to ear." "I'm not a panda bear or a brown bear?" questions the baby bear. "Enough of these questions," his father tells him. "You are absolutely 110% polar bear. So why do you ask?" "I wondered," said the baby bear, "because I'm freaking freezing." I relate these stories because I find myself increasingly empathizing with the polar bear as U.S.-Russian relations continue to chill, especially in the realm of nuclear arms control. The world's in a state of disarray, and while Sig may be correct in identifying that our countries are doomed to cooperate, at the moment, ironically and sadly, about the only issue in the nuclear sector on which they see eye to eye and indeed are collaborating is trying to block the negotiation of a ban on nuclear weapons, which is ongoing at this moment, a negotiation that's taking place in New York as we speak. Like Watson, I would argue, we are in danger of missing the obvious. The world has changed, and yet we're obsessed with old threats and fail to appreciate new ones. By the same token, we tend to focus almost exclusively on areas of discord and divergence rather than recognizing where common interests should prevail. So what I'm going to try to do in the 61 minutes that I have remaining here is to have us look back a little bit, to look at a period in time when the United States and the Soviet Union were both ideological adversaries and military rivals, and to suggest that even during that period of time, it was possible to develop and to sustain very significant forms of cooperation with respect to at least one issue, and that was the control of and the spread of nuclear weapons. And I think there are lessons to be derived from that historical experience, which may be relevant today. It also will alert us to some of the obstacles that are going to be, that we'll need to overcome if we're going to make any headway. So I've already mentioned kind of the amount of the length of time that I've spent studying this issue. What I found particularly strange, given today's world, is that when I went to graduate school, I was trained as a Soviet specialist at the University of Michigan a long time ago, and I took lots of different kinds of courses. There wasn't a single course available in the field of nonproliferation. So I'm basically self-taught. And that's one reason why it came as a surprise to me when I was writing my first book, which came out also in 1982, was the degree of cooperation that I discerned and the parallelism that I discerned, both in U.S. and Soviet nonproliferation policy generally, but particularly in the realm of nuclear export policy. And so what I do, I was skeptical the first day about how the view graphs might appear here, so I actually printed them out. Let me pass these out for you. Hopefully we have enough. This is just a, I can just pass them around here. What I've sought to do is to identify four periods in the evolution of both U.S.-Soviet and then U.S.-Russian nuclear export control and nonproliferation policy. I would suggest that this is these are rough periods of time. They don't they're not something that you should think of as fixed. In some instances, there was a gradual change in policy. In others, it was rather abrupt. But I think it may be a useful way to kind of think about the parallelism and the cooperation that took place long before the Soviet Union collapsed. And in fact, I wish Sig were here. I tried to provoke him. The cooperation that existed in this early period, in some ways, I think, was more substantial outside of the realm of science-to-science cooperation than you found even at the end of the Cold War. In any case, I'm going to go through this rather rapidly because I also like to dwell more on things that I was personally involved with. And while I'm elderly, I cannot really, on a first-hand basis, recall the first period of secrecy and denial that ran in both countries from 45 to 53. But I think the important thing to recall here was that in the U.S., this was a period when the Americans really sought to place the nuclear genie back into the bottle. They passed legislation, an Atomic Energy Act in 1946, which prohibited the exchange of information in the nuclear sector, even among our closest allies. I mean, the Brits and the Canadians worked with us in the Manhattan Project. You know, they were also excluded in terms of nuclear exchange. And at the international level, we had we sought to promote something that was known as the Baruch Plan, which many of you probably are familiar with. The idea basically was to create an international atomic development authority to which would be entrusted all phases of development of atomic energy. But the catch was the sequencing. The idea was that first we put in place this authority, we developed the intrusive forms of inspection, and only then do we disarm. The Soviet approach, not surprisingly, reversed the sequence. They wanted disarmament first before they would agree to have any form of inspections on their territory. And there were other issues having to do with the role that the United Nations would play. The U.S. at that time, interestingly, did not want the issue raised by the Baruch Plan to be subject to veto by any of the permanent members. And that was seen by Moscow, probably correctly, as an attempt to kind of marshal that international organization in efforts that could be directed against itself. In any case, during this period from 45 to 53, both sides were focused primarily on military aspects of the program. Efforts were conducted in great secrecy. That being said, it's also the case that the Soviet Union was exploiting with a vengeance The uranium deposits that they found in some of the other socialist countries. And they also were really wildly enthusiastic about the potential of nuclear energy. The change in policy in both the United States and the Soviet Union can be very neatly connected to a specific event. And that was President Eisenhower's famous Atoms for Peace speech before the United Nations in December of 1953, in which Eisenhower basically acknowledged that it would be impossible to keep the secret of the atom from other countries, and that it made sense, therefore, to try to promote those applications of the atom that could be used for civilian and peaceful purposes. And so you found the U.S. Legislation changing in 1954. There was a new Atomic Energy Act, which removed most of the controls of the classification of information in the nuclear sector. What's interesting, and very few people that I've encountered, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Soviet specialists and those who are also very familiar with nuclear energy, peaceful nuclear energy, recognized that immediately after Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace initiative, the Soviet Union responded in kind. They organized a whole series of meetings dealing with nuclear energy beginning in 1954. And there was this very unusual competition between the United States and the Soviet Union for support from and the allegiance of nuclear scientists, both in Western countries, but also particularly with respect to the developing world. And so one of the ironies, I think, of this period of relaxed control over nuclear information was the development of a U.S.-Soviet peaceful nuclear energy and prestige race, which really took place in tandem with the superpower arms race. And one aspect of this this competition was the rush by both the United States and the Soviet Union to declassify a tremendous amount of information, because it was still believed somehow that there was this distinction between good atoms for peace and bad atoms for war. And so a tremendous amount of information was released. And as one commentator noted at the time, and I'm quoting here, the nuclear giants lifted their skirts of secrecy, each challenging the other to reveal more evidence of dedication to the peaceful atom. The two decades that followed President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech in many respects represented a period of unusual consistency in U.S. Nuclear export and non-proliferation policy, which in my view continued until 1974. And this was a period when the United States, for the most part, was inclined to minimize the relationship between the development of nuclear energy in the civilian sector and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and basically to subordinate the military implications of nuclear weapons to those of commercial advantage. And that might not appear so obvious, but this was a period of tremendous U.S. advantage commercially, in the commercial sector, in the nuclear energy realm. And even the major non-proliferation accomplishment of that period, which was the negotiation of the 1998 non-proliferation treaty, was promoted by both superpowers as a great nuclear bargain, in which the nuclear powers would provide non-nuclear weapon states with civilian nuclear technology for peaceful purposes in exchange for a pledge by the recipients to forgo their nuclear weapons capability, any nuclear weapons capability. If there was an extended period of continuity on the U.S. side for approximately 20 years, it was a much shorter period on the Soviet side. And there was one reason for that. And that reason was China and the manner in which China effectively exploited Soviet nuclear assistance for a nuclear weapon. And if we had more time, I would be interested in talking with you about the Sino-Soviet nuclear relationship. One of SIG's colleagues, John Lewis, has a major book, you know, on that topic. But to make the story very, very short, in 1958, the Soviet Union had a change of heart, abruptly altered its nuclear export policy based upon its experience with China, and began what may be thought of as a period of technology control, a period that the United States didn't embrace until 1974. 1974 was significant because this was the time when, in May of 74, India conducted what it called euphemistically a peaceful nuclear explosion. An explosion that was successful in part because of assistance provided by the United States and Canada, among others. What was very significant in terms of looking at the evolution of U.S.-Soviet cooperation for nonproliferation was that very shortly after the Indian test, at the U.S. initiative, a new multilateral body was established, which started meeting in London during 1975, known as the London Suppliers Group, which subsequently became the Nuclear Suppliers Group. Significantly, in addition to the United States, one of the original seven members was the Soviet Union. I think it's instructive to look at some of the documents that were written at the time. And one of them is by one of the senior American experts, a man by the name of Charles Van Doren, who along with Ambassador Kislyak had a chapter in this book that had been published about 10 years later, in which, and I'm quoting from Van Doren, he writes, this was an internal memo to the State Department, "There are not export areas in which the Soviets have a less restrictive policy than we do, and the main purposes to be pursued in discussion with them would be to discuss our interest in further coordination of supplier policies." And this was evident because after the 58 experience with the Chinese, the Soviet Union basically tore up its prior nuclear agreements with its East European allies, particularly with Hungary and Czechoslovakia, because they became concerned that what they had promised to provide, or in some instances had provided, might be used for weapons purposes. They put in place a new policy where all spent fuel from the reactors from their that were produced from the reactors that they had assisted in the development of would be returned to the Soviet Union. They changed their position with respect to the wisdom of allowing their patrons from developing their own uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing facilities, and also introduced a number of innovations in the sphere of nuclear safeguards. And I actually had an opportunity to observe this this firsthand. SIG mentioned earlier this competition between Livermore and Los Alamos at a time when the University of California was managing the nuclear labs. And I was a young professor at UCLA at this period. And so one of the things that Livermore wanted to do was to encourage greater collaboration between the universities and the labs. And so they had a competition and they wanted to fund research by scholars that would demonstrate the openness of the labs and how they could, you know, work closely together. And I won one of those competitions. And the focus of my research had to do with Soviet nuclear export policy. And so I decided to look at four cases of Soviet export policy with respect to India, Libya, Cuba, and Argentina, all regarded as kind of problem countries. And I remember going to India. This would have been around 1982, if I'm not mistaken. And it was very, very interesting because the Indians and the Russian and the Soviet Union had a very good political relationship. I was not sure how I would be welcomed when I explain what I was doing. But when the Indians heard that I was, you know, investigating, researching Soviet-India nuclear relations, everybody was knocking on my door. I mean, the former Indian ambassador to the Soviet Union invited me over to his house. All of the Indian experts wanted to kind of spill the beans. And basically, the beans were that the Soviet Union was imposing unfair restrictions on India. India was dependent upon Soviet heavy water for the operation of the reactor. And the Soviet Union insisted on putting in place safeguards which had never been used before, which basically meant that the safeguards followed the material. If it moved from one facility to another, the safeguards had to move as well. And so that was simply an example of innovation in the area of nonproliferation, in which the Soviet Union was more advanced, more progressive, I would argue, than was Washington. But it wasn't simply in the area of nuclear export controls and safeguards. You found at the International Atomic Energy Board of Governors, at the General Conference of the IAEA, at the meetings of the Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference, which are held every 5 years. Again, this close collaboration and coordination of policies between our two countries. Indeed, in the interviews that I conducted when I was first doing my research, and I talked with many of the key players on both the American and on the Soviet sides, they reported that they actually found it much easier to cooperate with one another than the Americans did with many of their close allies, whether it was the Japanese, the French, the Germans, and the like, because we had a common interest in preventing other countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. And there are a kind of episodes in which when one party couldn't make a meeting, they basically gave their proxy to the other side. Again, this is during the peak of the Cold War. One of the corollaries of the emphasis at the time on technology control was the belief that one could predict proliferation behavior based on a country's technical prowess. In other words, it was assumed that countries with the technical capability to develop a nuclear weapon would seek to exercise that capability. This was known as kind of the technicist fallacy subsequently. And it gave rise to many inaccurate forecasts by national intelligence agencies, as well as scholars and journalists who were writing on the topic. There weren't that many, but there were some. The declassified U.S. National Intelligence Estimate for 1957, for example, identified a list of 10 leading weapons candidates, including Canada, Japan, and Sweden. Sweden, it was predicted, was likely to produce its first weapon about 1961, while it was forecast that Japan, and I'm quoting here, would probably seek to develop weapons programs within the next decade. And it's the same kind of fallacy which associates technical capability with the exercise of the capability that led President Kennedy in a famous press conference in 1963 to predict that the world could see 15, 20, or 25 new nuclear weapon states by the 1970s. That was not seen as an unrealistic forecast. By the end of the 1970s, there was a growing appreciation in Washington that this previous emphasis on technical capability was probably misplaced, and that there were other drivers of proliferation that might be as important, if not more important, than technology. And so it led to some reconsideration of the emphasis that should be given to technology control. At the same time, one began to see in both the United States and the Soviet Union a growing readiness to elevate political and economic considerations in the crafting of nonproliferation policy. The issue became more politicized. The United States, for example, chose to walk out of the IAEA General Conference in 1982 after the conference voted to withdraw Israel's credentials. You found polemics rising after President Reagan's 1983 Evil Empire speech. And in January of 1984, you even found the Soviet Union, for the first time, to the best of my knowledge, actually criticizing the United States for not implementing Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which emphasizes its disarmament obligations. Nevertheless, and this is what I think is particularly important to note, nevertheless, at this moment in time when there were strained U.S.-Soviet relations, at the 1985 Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, the two sides were able to adopt what a senior U.S. official, Lewis Dunn, some of you may know, at least, I don't know, Sig, if you know Lou, or Jack, if you knew Lou, what they called a no-polemics approach. And as both sides acknowledged that they had some basic disagreements, they particularly had difficulty about how to characterize the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, but they believed that it was in both countries' interests to produce an agreed document, a consensus final document. And what Dunn argues, and Lou was the head of the U.S. delegation to the 1985 review conference, was that this was in part due to both institutions that had grown up in both countries and individuals who shared a belief in the importance of the NPT and nonproliferation. A key player on the Russian side was Ambassador Roland Timirbayev, who was the principal negotiator of the NPT. His primary counterpart was a great individual by the name of George Bunn, who for many years was at Stanford. In any case, you found it's still possible to cooperate. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, however, under the Soviet Union, or in the Soviet Union under Gorbachev, I began to observe nuclear exports that I thought were questionable. And I was surprised because of this past record of collaboration and coordination between our two parties. These initiatives in particular had to do with the export of different goods and technologies to countries that either were not a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty or would not agree to place all of their nuclear facilities under comprehensive safeguards, so-called full-scope safeguards. I believed that one reason for this development was the decline in influence of the Soviet foreign ministry over nuclear export decisions and the corresponding rise in the power of the Ministry of Atomic Power and Industry. And in my view, and I missed perhaps the part where Sig talked about export controls, and we may have a somewhat different take on this, Sig, at this moment in time in the late 80s, before the collapse of the Soviet Union, you found under Gorbachev growing interest in hard currency considerations and diminished regard for the foreign or defense policy implications with respect to exports of sensitive technology. And I had a very personal encounter with respect to this issue because in 1990, I was invited as a still relatively young professor in Monterey to speak at the 1990 Carnegie Endowment International Conference on Nonproliferation on the topic of Soviet nonproliferation policy. And normally I would say that, you know, that's fine, I look forward to it. But I was very nervous because the commentator on my presentation was none other than Ambassador Roland Timirbayev, who was then the ambassador, the last Soviet ambassador to IAEA. So I nevertheless, you know, got up my courage and said what I wanted to say, and I basically said that notwithstanding prior stringent exports I observed a change in Soviet policy, and I attributed that to several things, including the absence of domestic legislation, the diminished influence that the foreign ministry had, and also, and this is relevant to what we're doing here today, the absence in the Soviet Union in that time of knowledgeable journalists or independent analysts who were prepared to write about non-proliferation issues. So I held my breath. I was getting ready to kind of run. I didn't know Tim Erbayev other than by name at that moment in time. And I was shocked when Tim Erbayev began to speak and said, much to my amazement, that unfortunately he had to agree with Professor Potter's assessment. And so following that meeting, I was actually going off to Moscow for meetings at MIGIMO at that time. And Tim Erbayev and I said we needed to cooperate. We needed to figure out a way to train young Soviet analysts to better appreciate the common interests that they had with the United States in strengthening nonproliferation and reinvigorating nuclear export controls. And thus was born a project which continues to this day. It started out as our Soviet nonproliferation kind of training program with support from Carnegie Corporation of New York. I think it's even before your time, Pat. I think Jane Wales was the program officer who first started us on that route. And more importantly, though, I was able to recruit Ambassador Tim Erbayev as the first director, our first diplomat in residence and director of our international organizations, the Nonproliferation Program. And Tim Erbayev then spent 3 years with me in Monterey and helped us to mentor these young individuals. There was a core group that we set up in 1991. We introduced the first course in nonproliferation at MIGIMO, and thus was really born our what is now our Eurasia Nonproliferation Program, which has trained well over 200 young scientists, government officials, journalists from almost all of the post the post-Soviet states. I want to tell you one other story here, which may or may not correspond with Sig's recollection. It has to do with an unusual form of cooperation, and then it developed into something that I think was not terribly helpful. And it involved something that was known as the International Chetek Corporation. This was an entity that was born in 1990 and made a more public appearance in 1991. And it was basically an effort by a number of Soviet and then Russian scientists to market so-called peace for nuclear explosives for environmental purposes. I still have in my files these glossy brochures. They work particularly closely with the Canadians. This was an interesting initiative, which I went back and I looked at the second article I wrote, op-ed I wrote for the New York Times, came out in November of 91. And there was a big story that Bill Broadhead on the front page at the time. And he actually cited a Livermore scientist, who I won't mention, who said, really, that's not a bad idea. You know, it's a very neat technical solution to getting rid of chemical wastes, chemical weapons. The problem was that it seemed not to recall very clearly Soviet as well as American obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And what was also rather dangerous was the fact that it was being promoted by the Russian Atomic Energy Ministry, which was providing subsidies to these scientists in return for exclusive marketing rights to Soviet peaceful nuclear explosives. And I must say that Mr. Mikhailov was an early promoter of this particular initiative. The incentive on the Russian side, of course, was to support their scientists. So it may have made sense in terms of keeping the, or staunching the brain drain, but it was not helpful from a non-proliferation standpoint. I'm not going to dwell on the cooperative threat reduction program. Obviously, SIG has spoken eloquently about that. I think the only point that I would make is that while there was cooperation that took place of a very significant kind in the period that's identified in the handout, that doesn't mean that the United States and the Russian Federation saw eye to eye with respect to a variety of proliferation challenges. And if we have time, we might talk a little bit about differences in U.S. and Russian perspectives. They pertained, among other things, to the dangers of nuclear terrorism. And while certainly, as SIG has really marvelously demonstrated, you had this tremendous interaction and camaraderie among U.S. and Russian scientists, there was not always the same degree of enthusiasm for collaboration when it came to some of the other ministries, particularly in the foreign ministry, the defense ministry. And when you looked at collaboration internally as opposed to collaboration with respect to other proliferation hotspots at the time. And I'm pleased to chat with you more about that when we get to the Q&A. One significant change during this last period, which is still part of the, what I call the primacy of politics, was the emergence at somewhat different points in time in both the United States and the Russian Federation of what I would call a policy of nonproliferation exceptionalism. And I think the best illustration of nonproliferation exceptionalism has to do with the change, really a dramatic shift in U.S. nuclear export policy in 2005. And that had to do with the tearing up of over, a quarter of a century of congressionally mandated export control policy with respect to India in particular. The U.S.-India nuclear deal and the exemption that was granted to India by the nuclear suppliers group, basically by twisting the arms, if not breaking the arms, of many of our allies, in a very unfortunate fashion, in my view, because it was directly contrary to agreements that had been reached in 1995, when the nonproliferation treaty was extended indefinitely. It was reiterated in 1990 and 2000, rather in 2000, and also was at odds with a number of legally binding agreements in the form of nuclear weapons free zones. What's interesting to note, though, is that this was a policy which was also supported by the Russian Federation. So while I might argue, and I have argued, that this was very imprudent nonproliferation policy, it was another area in which the United States and the Russian Federation cooperated quite closely. Let me summarize these areas these different phases of collaboration. I want to highlight an area of divergence, and then I want to talk about two very specific cases and wrap up by two so that we have plenty of time for Q&A. I would argue that during this last phase, what I call the primacy of politics, what you generally observe is a downgrading of the importance of nonproliferation as a policy priority in both countries. And with that, I think you also see a diminished influence of domestic organizational and institutional advocates for stringent export controls. There are parallel developments. I mean, one indication of this was the demise of TechSnob Export, which was the main export control body during the Soviet period. It's kind of reappeared now. But the foreign ministry and the defense ministry just don't play the role that they used to play on export policy. And I think you see, to some extent, similar differences in the case of the U.S., where there's a sense that at best we may be able to curtail but not prevent the spread of proliferation. Let me turn to these two cases that I have some more direct connection to. One has to do with U.S.-Soviet cooperation in preventing South Africa from conducting a nuclear test in the summer of 1977. And the second has to do with U.S.-Russian cooperation with the U.S.-Russian cooperation in the implementation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The first case is very unusual. Not all of the information is available, but it's unusual because of the sensitive intelligence information that was exchanged. Basically, it involved the preparations in the Kalahari Desert, a site called Bastrop, where it appeared that the South African government was prepared in July and August of 1977 to conduct a nuclear test. Kind of the backdrop to this was the fact that in the mid-1970s, South Africa had been actively involved in the development of a peaceful, so-called peaceful nuclear program. It was designed ostensibly for its mining industry. The United States, while it was, it included South Africa on its list of prospective or nth country proliferators, didn't really think at that time that it was going to pursue this program too actively. And in fact, it engaged in providing some significant nuclear assistance in the form of both fuel and reactor technology. So it was rather startling when on August 6, 1977, President Jimmy Carter received a message from Secretary General Leonid Brezhnev informing him that Soviet satellites had discerned activities which suggested preparations by the South Africans of a nuclear test. And Brezhnev asked the United States for assistance in preventing that test. Acting on this intelligence information, and it's a fascinating story how this was all communicated, and I can talk to you more about that if you're interested. The U.S. sent a light aircraft belonging to a military attaché in Pretoria over the test site. It also sought intelligence information from a reconnaissance satellite. And much to the surprise of U.S. government officials, our intelligence matched that of that was provided by the Soviet Union. And so on August 18th, the U.S. confronted the South Africans with this information, proposed a technical visit to the site, and we now know that immediately the South African government told everybody to clean up the mess and make sure that nothing was found. One of the things that's quite interesting is the fact that the Soviet Union probably learned of this test, probably sent its satellites over to confirm it from a spy that they had embedded in the Soviet Navy. There were several spies. This has been acknowledged, actually, by the Russian Foreign Ministry. There's also evidence that the U.S. had collected satellite imagery of the test preparations before they had been informed by the Soviet Union, but had never bothered to analyze the information. But what's probably most relevant for our purposes in terms of looking at U.S., lessons of U.S. Soviet cooperation was that when the issue became public and it was raised at the United Nations, rather than exploiting the issue for propaganda purposes, the Soviet Union basically acted in what U.S. Ambassador Jim Leonard referred to as a very careful and moderate fashion. You see similar notes that are now available in unclassified or declassified archives, communications between Ambassador Victor Israelian and Jim Leonard. And in fact, there's one in which Victor Israelian writes that he would like to do better than just avoid confrontation with the U.S. and non-proliferation, including the South African case. We really want to cooperate. So I think it gives you a sense of what the environment was like in the 70s. And I'll return to that in just a moment, that case, to derive some lessons. Running out of time here. The area of cooperation that I know best has to do with the cooperation in the context of the NPT. Having been a delegate to every NPT meeting, every review conference, every PrepCom since 1995, representing the country of Kyrgyzstan. I think, well, I can't match the record of Jack Matlock in diplomacy. I think even Jack has not been handed a démarche by a Russian official when he was not representing the United States. And so I can say that I did receive one, which I then had to communicate to the Kyrgyz ambassador. But in any case, there were some fascinating episodes of collaboration and cooperation. They entailed first the negotiation of the NPT, and I plan to talk more about that. I'm going to skip over most of that. There's a very, very important, really the definitive study of these negotiations by now a very elderly but unusual individual by the name of Ambassador Mohammed Shaker. He was actually the president of the 1985 conference that I mentioned earlier. He wrote for his dissertation a three-volume study. It's available online on our website if you're interested. And it talks about how the United States and the Soviet Union were able to overcome some key issues. They had to do in particular with the question of the so-called multilateral force, what to do with U.S. plans to basically provide our allies in Europe, including West Germany, with access to a fleet of ballistic missile submarines and warships, something that you can imagine the Soviet Union was not very enthusiastic about. But ultimately, we were able to overcome that obstacle and others. So the two cases that I'm going to mention in a telegraphic fashion. One has to do with 1995, which was when the NPT was extended indefinitely. And that was not anything that was preordained. Basically, the Russian delegation, which was co-chaired by our friend Sergei Kislyak and also Grigory Berdyennikov, they were in close contact with cooperation, meeting on a daily basis with the Western group that was chaired by Ambassador Tom Graham. And what's so interesting is the way in which these two nuclear powers found common cause, particularly in dealing with the non-nuclear weapon states. But one of the problems that was encountered, and this also is rather interesting, prior to 1994, the Soviet Union and the United States and Russia and the United States could sit down and they can kind of plot out their strategy without regard to the French and the Chinese. The British basically were engaged in what the Americans wanted them to do. But when France and China joined the NPT in the early 1990s, it greatly complicated the process. Because the many Americans, I don't know, Jack, what your view is, but many Americans regarded the French as much more troublesome on almost any issue than the Russians. And that was certainly the case when you were talking about nuclear weapons. And the Chinese introduced another dimension. So it made it much more difficult to prepare for these negotiations when you were dealing with the P5 rather than just dealing on a U.S.-Soviet or U.S.-Russian basis. Nevertheless, on the key issue, which had to do with a resolution on the Middle East, the United States and the Russians collaborated and made it possible to extend the treaty indefinitely without a vote. Fast forward 20 years to 2015. At this conference, the two main debates focused on nuclear disarmament, and especially the demands for most of the non-nuclear weapon states to give a lot of attention to the issue of the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons, and also then on the failure to implement the 1995 resolution on the Middle East, which had been reiterated and modified at the 2010 review conference. What I found particularly interesting in 2015, at a time when the United States and Russia had exceptionally difficult relations, particularly over Ukraine, was the fact that the U.S. basically kept silent when the Russians were banging on the heads, particularly of Ukrainians, during the first 2 weeks of the conference, because the Americans thought it was more important to collaborate with Russia in trying to reach an agreement on the Middle East. And I can say more about that, if you wish, later. When it proved impossible for the Americans and the Russians to negotiate an agreement that was acceptable to the Americans on the Middle East, the Russians then changed their tactics. And what they ultimately decided to do was to throw their support to the Egyptians and the Arab League, knowing that they wouldn't get an agreement from the review conference, but they preferred to go down on the issue of the Middle East, where they sided with majority, rather than to fall on the side of the minority on disarmament, where they and the French basically were the two who were the obstructionists. Okay, what lessons from these two cases? I would argue that at a time when U.S.-Russian relations continue to deteriorate, we need to better understand how we were able to find common ground during the Cold War on nonproliferation. And I think among the cases that I've mentioned here and others that we are studying as part of a major project at the center, one has to recognize that cooperation and nonproliferation was seen as advancing both sides' national interests. I think that's a theme that we've heard, you know, over the course of the last 2 days. Compromise was seen as a necessary condition for collaboration. For example, when it came to the Kalahari test site, the U.S. was prepared to accept fallout from its strong stance against South Africa testing, even if it meant doing some damage to other objectives involving states in South Africa, including Rhodesia and Namibia, where it was aligned with Pretoria against Soviet-backed liberation movements. Similarly, the Russians, and this in some ways is even more astonishing, the Soviet Union was prepared to share sensitive intelligence information even when it meant possibly exposing the human intelligence sources that it had, that it tipped them off. Relevant to the South African case, I think prior cooperative experiences between Washington and Moscow in other nonproliferation fora, including the negotiation of the NPT, the establishment of the Nuclear Suppliers Group, collaboration on safeguards issues at the International Atomic Energy Agency, and Dr. Sokoff, who's just joined us here, has written a very important study on that topic. All of these prior instances of collaboration, I think, contributed to the willingness of both parties to take certain risks in order to work together to prevent South Africa from advancing its nuclear weapons program, which would have been a development that neither side welcomed. For both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, another motivation to cooperate in 1977 appears to have stemmed from their appreciation that South African test preparations afforded them an opportunity to improve bilateral relations. This was an area that they recognized they could cooperate on, and so they did so. It's also very interesting to note how the South Africans viewed this situation. There are cables that are now available, diplomatic cables, that my CNS colleague Sarah Bidgood has uncovered, And there's one particularly interesting one written by a South African diplomat who notes in August of 1977, and I'm quoting, "A group of nations who otherwise compete on a wide range of matters, including nuclear ones, were able to get together and act forcefully and fast to indicate to a prospective new nuclear power that the consequent what the consequences would be if it went ahead. Nothing like that," the cable continues, "occurred at the time of India's nuclear explosion in 74. Also, I think it's really important to highlight the role played by individuals and institutions. Lou Dunn has written, I think, very effectively about how the creation of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency of the United States in 61 became such a strong bureaucratic proponent for nonproliferation. By the same token, you had Timur Bayev and some of his colleagues in the foreign ministry playing those very significant roles. And just as Sig talked about these personal relationships that developed between scientists, you had similar relationships developed between U.S. and Soviet and then U.S. and Russian arms control negotiators, which were equally important in making it possible to move forward in collaboration. I have my own stories, which I'm dying to tell you, but I don't think I have time. So I will probably not relate my own personal experiences in the review conference. But I had a number of them, which again illustrated the importance of these personal ties. So let me conclude by looking at what has to be done today, and then we'll have at least 10 or 15 minutes for Q&A. What are the lessons that we can derive? First, I would suggest that there's a need for both sides to revisit why they cooperated so closely in the past, even when they could agree on so few other security issues. I think one way to accomplish this review is to have a full and frank official dialogue. I emphasize official dialogue among experts and policymakers in both countries about their nonproliferation and NPT related interests. Ideally, one would restore the past practice of having high-level bilaterals every 6 months on nonproliferation issues. I may not have mentioned that in my attempt to run through these different periods quickly, but you had for a period of about 10 years bilateral meetings taking place at the assistant secretary level. Ambassador Richard Kennedy often was the American participant, and everything was on the table. We talked about all issues, and we often, at least on the technical ones, could agree. On the political ones, we might not agree, but we could talk about them. I think it's critically important to revive the nonproliferation institutional memory that appears to have been largely lost, and to replenish cadres of nonproliferation specialists in both countries. We're trying to do that, again, with support from a number of foundations, including Carnegie, but also, in this instance, very importantly, MacArthur. We have these Track 1.5 meetings that are ongoing four times a year, which bring together senior experts. And in one instance, we are looking particularly at these a whole series of cases where young as well as more senior Americans and Russians are studying these particular episodes in the past, looking for clues going forward. Finally, I think it would be prudent today to recall that U.S.-Soviet cooperation during the Cold War was in no way preordained. Rather, decision makers at the time perceived that working together served their mutual interests in spite of challenging circumstances in their bilateral relations. And I think that's a lesson that policymakers in both Washington and Moscow would do well to recall. So although I rushed through this, hopefully it gives you a sense of this cooperation in the past. And I would be pleased to take any questions that you may have about any of the points that I raised or other points as well.